Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking with Reggie Finley again this week, we're talking this week about atheism. We did mostly politics last week. Welcome again, Reggie.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have debated religion and atheism, the arguments for atheism, with many, many people. You have a call-in show. Unlike me, I don't have the courage to actually have the hoi polloi call in on my show, and maybe I'm just an elitist. I like to talk to people who've written a book or do a radio show like you. But at any rate, you have talked with people at all spectrums of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think the principal underlying arguments are that people have in their head who are theists that need to be undermined and attacked? And
well, of course, the whole problem, first of all, is that they assume that there's this God, and of course they read a book, and that's where they pretty much get this idea from. And we continue to perpetuate the beliefs really because our mommy and daddy told us to believe them. And that's really the real reason why it continues to progress. And of course, if you have a belief, anything that is evidential or just perceived to be evidence, like, I don't know, you got a raise on your job or you got a new car. And if you have a belief in which you believe that, well, these things are going to be given to you because of your relationship with your God, then that's just reinforcement for that belief. And there's really no evidence, though, that there is a deity up there doing anything at all. But so that's one of the more powerful emotional arguments that believers have for their God belief, is the personal experience argument. However, many of them are lacking, and there's no evidence for them. I'm like, okay, well, is there a videotape of this miracle? No. Okay, well, can God do something for me right now? Well, he's not going to bow down to your whim. But the personal experience argument is probably one of the more harder ones to debate, because how do you argue with someone who claims they had something happen to them? That's kind of difficult. Another argument they use, of course, is a design argument. I think this is one of their other more powerful arguments. I think, they both can be refuted, I think, but this is one of the more harder ones, that everywhere you look, there's complexity everywhere, and everything seems to be designed for a particular purpose. Things have come to be. Therefore, they must have come to be with purpose, just as we create things with purpose. And that's pretty much what you hear. But what they ignore, though, however, are the many stronger philosophical arguments against a God, or arguments that actually justify non-belief. And many of those, of course, are, I wrote this argument myself, and there are many variations, but I call this the argument for atheism, assuming the Christian God exists. Okay? And essentially, without breaking it down line by line, essentially the argument is, well, if God exists, he would know that before creating us, who would believe in him and who wouldn't. He would know what evidences would be sufficient to know who would know that he exists and who wouldn't. That being the case, he must want atheists to exist because, well, atheists are here. In other words, he's not providing the evidence that's necessary to convince people, all people, that God exists. And some would argue, well, he has, but you just ignore the evidence. But that just proves my point here, is that it's not sufficient evidence. Sufficient evidence is undeniable. You cannot deny sufficient evidence. I mean, the evidence would be sufficient enough for me to know that God exists.
Okay, and I think my listeners are probably getting a scratching head at this point, so let me reintroduce you. Speaking of Reggie Finley, he's the producer of Infidel Guy Radio, which is an atheist radio network program, and he is the Infidel Guy at infidelguy.com. Now, okay, so your notion is that if there was a God and he was omnipotent and,
right,
and omniscient, knew
right
everything, that they would have known, this God would have known that we were going to create atheists, and that atheists would fill some kind of cosmic purpose. But see, if you were a Christian, everything is part of God's plan. So, you know,
it depends. I forgot the guy's name now, who believes in predestination, Calvinist. I mean, if you're a Calvinist, yes, that works, okay? Because essentially, no matter what happens, a God has just designed it this way, that's it. Yeah, he made atheists to go to hell. Fine, that's just what. But not most believers believe that.
Well, but see, atheists could be a test for the true Christian's faith. We could be the agents of Satan's temptation.
That is true. And the problem with that, though, is still, okay, fine, that's good for you, but what about the atheists? See, and most believers don't want to believe that God will create people just to go to hell. God creates people for particular purposes. Well, if God creates me for a particular purpose, and that is being an atheist, then why would I be denied heaven if I am fulfilling his holy purpose, his divine purpose?
So, this is where Mormonism comes in, because they get to baptize you retrospectively and cleanse your sins and allow you to go to heaven, no matter what you did.
No matter what you do. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
That's why the Mormons are into genealogy, because they go back and they find all they need is the name and the birth date, I think, of their ancestors. And once they say their name in a ritual in the Mormon temple, then they get to go to heaven.
That's amazing. Tic-tac-toe in a wall, whatever, and you know, all these really weird rituals that no one can explain. Just do something silly and poof, you're saved. It's really crazy.
See, the direction I thought you were going with God being an atheist despite the existence of God,
right,
is along the lines of the movie The Rapture. Have you ever seen that?
No, I have not seen that.
It's a wonderful film. It's based on the notion that this woman, she goes from a life of sin, she becomes a born-again Christian, she is a part of an apocalyptic cult. They convince her that the rapture is about to occur. So she takes her daughter out into the desert, and they're waiting for this to happen. And they're both starving to death out in the desert, and her daughter's really suffering. And she finally believes, so, you know, we're going to be in heaven shortly anyway. So she kills her daughter. And then she gets caught by the police. She's put in jail. And then the rapture actually does occur. And all the doors fling open, and all the saved people disappear, and all the unsaved are wandering around. And she gets taken up before God, and this is a major motion feature film. She's taken up before God at the end of the film, and he says, all you have to do, since you killed your daughter, that was a sin, but all you have to do to come into heaven is say that you're sorry,
right,
and repent your sin.
Right.
And she's so pissed off at this point that God didn't send her a sign to say, don't kill your daughter, you know, where it's just about to happen around the corner, you don't need to kill your daughter.
Right.
She's so pissed off about this that she gives him the finger, basically, and goes
wow.
to hell.
Wow.
Right. So I thought this is an awesome theological message for America, which is basically, okay, postulate that there is a God. Right? Postulate
right.
that he did set all this up.
Right.
It still doesn't solve the problem of a God who's so cruel that he sets up this kind of world, and that kind of God still deserves the finger, right? Does not deserve our obeisance. It's like the old subgenius thing, you know, Yahweh is a cruel tyrant from the planet Oberon, and we need to fight him.
Exactly. That's what a lot of people don't understand, seem to think about either. Even if God is the supreme power that created everything, why is it that we really need to worship him? You would think that if a God truly were holy in all these omnis, that he would be beyond something as simple as worship. I mean, men want worship. Men like reinforcement. Men need these things. A God wouldn't need such things.
Right. Lords need them. That's where it all comes from. It's,
right.
it's part of
right.
the reinforcement of our ancient hierarchical societies that the lords and the priests and the kings were all able to identify themselves
exactly.
with the religious authority figure.
Exactly. And they needed that because it was a way to, of course, keep power over people. But yet God has no such need. And yet, of course, the believers assert that, well, God does have a need. He wants us to love him freely, that we need to come to God, and that's what God wants. And, of course, that begs the question, once, why would a God want anything? We didn't have to exist. Nothing needs to exist. So a deeper question I ask is, well, why, if God exists, why does anything exist? I mean, if God is already all-knowing and knows the beginning of the end of everything, I don't even see why one single atom even exists if God is the creator of everything. He knows how it's all going to end anyway and has a plan.
Okay, we were talking yesterday about transhumanism, and you know that there are some aspects of transhumanism that people suspect have a quasi-religious tone. One of those is that many transhumanists imagine that we will evolve into godlike beings.
Okay.
And that line of speculation, that eventually the entire universe might get turned into some kind of super intelligent gray goo, and intelligence might be coded into the quantum level of the quarks, and universes might become so intelligent that they give birth to new universes which have intelligence coded into the very nature of their being. Okay. So that,
okay.
there's a line of speculation like that, and Frank Tipler is one guy who wrote a book that's a kind of a synthesis of transhumanism
right,
and Christianity.
Right.
you know, even if that were true, even if
right.
even if there was this kind of super intelligence, and we were all living in some kind of
right.
simulation that of reality that they created, mm-hmm. there still wouldn't be any reason to worship.
Exactly, and then I can't help but wonder, and what would be the purpose of this organism or this creature or this universal consciousness that I've always heard about? What purpose could it have for itself? I mean, I remember doing a little writing down on this piece of paper, and I thought about what if I knew everything there was to know in the universe, and I could not help but continue to get to the point where that God would be completely indistinguishable from what appears to be the non-conscious universe, because obviously God thinks, I'm going to go do this. Oop, but wait a minute, I knew I was going to do this before, and I knew the outcome. Oop, I don't like that outcome, so I'm not going to do it. Why do anything? I mean, it just doesn't seem a very viable philosophy or idea that you have a God need to create anything. It's just ridiculous. So I think that if anything, all I see is a non-conscious universe out there. I don't see that there is a God doing anything.
I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. We're speaking with Reggie Finley today. He's the producer of a program called Infidel Guy Radio at infidelguy.com. Now, I did my bachelor's thesis on Pentecostalism, and I know that you're familiar with Pentecostalism. Growing up there in Atlanta, Georgia, you must have been to one or another Pentecostal services and seen some speaking in tongues in your time.
Yep.
Now, I spent 4 months, 4 services a week, 4-hour services doing my bachelor's thesis, and got a pretty good taste of the whole Pentecostal thing. And the question that I was looking at back then was, what role does a religious experience like speaking in tongues play in our society? Why do people, obviously there's a kind of stress relief function to this.
Right.
And there's some, you know, like just like meditation or prayer can have some positive, mm-hmm. beneficial psychological or physical effects, which don't have anything to do with the religious,
exactly.
religious claims.
Right.
But what other roles for society might they play? And one of the things that I postulated back then that I still kind of believe is that these irrational states that people can get themselves into, which isn't a bad thing in this case. It's not. It's just a state other than reason. It's a state of ecstasy or a state of something like that. These states can then be used to bond in a kind of unquestioning way all the beliefs that people have about the way society should work. So, in other words, if you try to scratch one of these Pentecostals and you say, why do you believe X, Y, and Z? They say, well, because I had this experience and I can't question anything because this experience validates all my beliefs. Right?
Exactly.
It occurred in the context of those beliefs. It was so wonderful that I wouldn't want to, you know, question it and say anything bad about it. So I think this is one of the most difficult aspects of religion, is that it's undergirded by something that's completely irrational. And so you can get as far as you want with these rational arguments with the religious, and at the end, it's about something that's beyond reason.
Yep, and of course, and it depends on who you're talking to. Again, I think we talked about this last week. You have many people who are mostly liberal believers anyway, and I think some of them do listen. I think, of course, but you mentioned the Pentecostals, of course, and you're fundamentalists. It's a little different story there, but for me, I'm a strong advocate of the Socratic method of argumentation. Essentially, I want people to I ask people questions about their belief, and they respond, and I really do it in a very honest and genuine way. I don't do it as attacking. And when they say they don't know, I go, okay, well, hopefully they'll go find out and come back. And if they do and they continue to do this, they begin to see some of the holes and some of the flaws in their belief system. And the whole speaking in tongue things is just really weird. I sometimes think some of the people who actually flip out in church and have all these weird experiences, I really think they might be kind of self-inducing some type of temporal lobe episode.
It's actually quite fascinating. When you go around the world, there are possession cults in almost every society around the world. And these possession cults, they all pretty much do the same thing. The vocal production that's been recorded is all pretty much the same. So there's some button at the base of our brain, our hind brain, that people can figure out how to push. And when you push that, then all this babble comes out.
See, and that's what's so funny. That's what's so interesting about temporal lobe seizures, is that that's exactly what happens when someone has a temporal lobe episode. You start to you have auditory and physical hallucinations, and and you just name it. There's just so many. You have visual, auditory, physical, and they just have this holy, this religious experience. And some people can get one experience and not have it for the rest of their life. Some people can have them multiple times. And just last week on my program, someone called into one of my programs and told me that her aunt was actually having having a hoop and holler session in church, speaking in tongues, and she fell out. Doctors came in, the paramedics came in, hauled her away to the hospital. Lo and behold, she had a seizure. And I thought that was really interesting because if people to do the research, go to drcoop.com, do a search for temporal lobe seizures, and you will see the exact same phenomenon. I'm not saying all of them do it. I think some of them do it because it's expected of them. But the symptoms are just too coincidental. One part of your body is moving while the other stays relatively limp. The weird babble, the profuse sweating, dizziness, seeing God, talking God, feeling another presence. And, of course, we know that that's always, if anyone has studied anything about temporal lobe aberrations, that sensing yourself can happen to anyone. And that's one of those temporal lobe episodes I'm talking about. But some people just simply have them more frequently than others. So I found that research into that very, very interesting. And I think that there might be more people out there having seizures than they realize.
Well, this is very interesting because I think that one of the things that's already happening is that, as you say, people are understanding the way the brain functions and that things like end-of-life experiences, out-of-body experiences,
right,
the presence of God, the presence of ghosts and things like that are all perfectly explainable in terms of things that happen chemically and electrically inside your brain.
Exactly.
But the flip side of that and what's going to happen in the future is that we're going to be increasingly able to push those buttons ourselves with drugs and with nanotechnology and with electrodes.
Right.
And as we do that, I can't help but think, you know, maybe some religions will be flexible enough and quick enough on their feet to incorporate these technologies and this new evidence.
Right.
But it seems like most religions would be profoundly challenged
when
people are able to say, hey, I don't have to spend 10 years meditating or praying to do what you do. I just do it with a flick of a switch.
Mm. Well, yeah, and of course, it also caused difficulty with the concept of the soul. I think for a lot of people, the longer we extend our lives and the more we find out about the brain, it's going to be more and more difficult. I always ask people, what does the soul do? And everything they name to me, I go, well, we know the brain does that. I mean, you shut the brain down. And it's interesting, I had a program in which we talked about that. Essentially, we talked about the various parts of the brains and what they do. Well, essentially, we started with the whole human first. This is one of my arguments against the soul, actually. We start with the whole human, and we say, okay, where's the soul? And no one can really pinpoint it. I'll say, okay, let's chop off the arms and the legs. Can the body still be alive? Well, sure, we can have that person still be alive, okay? Now, let's shut down all the processes that deal with beating, the heart beating and lungs and nutrients, and we can just hook them all up to machines. Now you have nothing but a head sitting there. Now let's start taking parts of the brain out. And you can continue to do this, as I'm sure anyone who works in neuroscience, and you can take certain parts of the brain out, and that person will still be considered alive. You know, you can take the eyes out. You can take away their hearing, all their ways they can perceive and sense. But yet there's still something happening in that brain. Where's the soul at?
We talked to on your program a little while ago about transhumanism and its opposition to the idea of the human as a discrete category. And what you're talking about is precisely the parallel, the human is a crypto-Christian term in our modern society for the soul. When people don't feel comfortable talking about the soul in mixed company or secular company, intellectual company, they talk about what's human, what's human dignity and things like that. It has, it's exactly the same problem. You know, okay, are you still human if you have a genetic deformation that you grow fur all over your body like a bear? Yeah, well, you're still human. Are you still human if you don't have any arms and legs? And if you have two heads sprouting out of your shoulder? Well, yeah, of course you're still human then. Well, what is it about that makes you really human? Well, I don't know. It's something, you know, something in there is what makes you human. It's exactly the same argument.
Yeah, exactly. And people have a lot of difficulty with that. And again, you're right, people just assume that, you know, these things exist because it's part of their theology, but there's really no evidence outside of their holy books and their own subjective experience.
Okay, so when you go on college campuses, when you talk to young people, you know, most people who are believers are pretty easy to argue with because they don't actually have any theological arguments under their belt. You know, you ask them what's their concept of God. They go, I don't know. God is love. You know, okay.
Right.
Well, how do you argue with that?
Well, of course. I mean, if they say God is love, well, love is a secondary characteristic. I mean, you have to have humans or first to know what love is. But the problem with that is when they start saying God is love, then well, so is God hate too? Well, no, God's not hate. Then how would you know? Why do you think he's love? If God is everything, surely he'd be hate too. I mean, why do you think God is just love? I just kind of show them how they selectively pick out attributes that they'd like their God to have, essentially creating their own God.
Well, that's, I guess, one of the fundamental rhetorical strategies, is that the Christian idea of God and the Jewish monotheistic idea of God is so all-encompassing,
right,
that that they have a problem then explaining how God wouldn't know certain things or why God would allow
exactly
certain things. The other monotheistic, non-monotheistic religions, the polytheistic religions, seem to have less of a problem in that direction because, like Hinduism,
right,
yeah, there is a kind of universal Atman, but it's
right
so abstract, and the gods that they really deal with are these kind of much more like Greek, Greco-Roman
right
type
they're
gods.
Limited beings.
They're limited beings, super beings of some kind.
Right.
And I think it's probably a very different thing to argue with somebody from that background. I haven't spent a lot of time since high school arguing with, like,
yeah.
In high school, I used to argue with Hare Krishnas, actually.
Yeah, either. I can't think of any time I really had to debate someone on those particular beliefs. But you're right. The whole concept that God actually is this omni character causes a lot of problems because, indeed, all these various characteristics, and that really solid characteristics, actually, they're telling you what God isn't, not what God is. And they really don't realize that. They just throw these things out there. And again, either they describe God via secondary characteristics like love and whatever, or jealousy, as the Bible says, or they'll say he's omni-this. They'll say, well, he's all of this, but not that. Because to attempt to define God, of course, is to limit that God. And of course, well, why call that God? So we can't put limits on God. In fact, science can never, ever find God. It's very odd that you see a lot of articles periodically in Christian literature or now and again want to pop up in Time or whatever. Has science found God? Science will never find God. That's the last thing I think Christian believers want. They say they want evidence to support their claim. They really do. Because what's wrong with a little more evidence? But at the same time, it's a catch-22. But if you get that evidence, then God would now be definable. And once you do that, again, I mean, why call it God? It's now just a super advanced alien creature that we now understand.
See, I'm humble enough to think that probably all these arguments that we think are self-evident, they have been well considered by the finest Jesuit philosopher someplace, and that we would probably get our butts kicked if we actually were in a debate with, you know, some of the leading theological philosophers around the world. So what are the leading texts that you think people should go to, the most important current arguers for the atheist point of view, that they could arm themselves and understand what the history of argumentation for secular point of view has been?
Well, the really interesting thing to me, first of all, before I give you a list of a few names in here, I'd like to say that I think that anyone who really thinks about this enough, if you sit down and start writing down your questions, writing down some of your arguments, you will inevitably come up with some of the same problems, conundrums, and solutions that many of the top thinkers in the world come up with in regards to philosophy and theological arguments for and against God. So, but I'd say for the beginner, I would say maybe Atheism by George H. Smith. Also, Atheism and Philosophical Justification by Michael Martin, after you read that book. And, of course, theistic books, of course, you can read books by Lee Strobel. And there's a lot of names that escape me right now. William Lane Craig, Greg Bonson, these are some of the names, and presuppositionalist apologetics,
seems like C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis, that's right.
C.S. Lewis is someone that I see a lot of Christians
right
saying, you know, I used to be an atheist, and then I read C.S. Lewis, and now I'm a Christian, blah, blah, blah.
yeah, but when I start looking at some of this work, I go, these are very weak arguments. I mean, there's no substance to this. Essentially, almost every single argument that I've ever come across, they like to pad it with complex theological and philosophical jargon. But when you really take it apart, which is what I've had to learn to do for over 5 years doing my program, because I'm talking to normal people a lot of the times, it really comes down to, why does anything exist? Period. That's it. And it's a matter of what they want to believe. They want to believe that God did it. I'm saying I have no evidence. And I'd like to take this time, if I would, to describe atheism then while I'm at it, talking about a lack of evidence here.
Please do.
I want listeners to understand that as an atheist, I'm not saying that there absolutely is no God. What I'm saying is that there is a lack of evidence. Now, so you could classify me as a weak atheist or an agnostic atheist. There are some strong atheists who will make a positive claim that there is no God, and I can take that position as well, depending upon what God we're talking about. And I think it's so evident that believers discard other gods of other religions, but yet they hold on to theirs. And the same arguments that you utilize to discount other gods, you don't apply to your own God. And I think people should really maybe analyze that a little bit, think deeply about that. If it's not just an argument from personal experience, if it's just not the Bible and they really thought about this a bit, I mean, that might be something else to consider. So as an atheist, and I don't think I'm better than anyone else, I don't think that Christians are not as intelligent because they aren't atheists. I understand many of the emotional reasons why people believe the way they do and some of their personal experiences for the reason why they believe what they believe. I just don't think there's any evidence. And again, my argument that I stated at the beginning of the program is pretty difficult to refute. And again, that is, if God wants me to know that he exists, then I would know it. If he doesn't, then I guess I won't. But if he doesn't, then as an atheist, my atheistic position is justified in not believing. So pretty much, I'm not going to depend on man anymore to let me to give me the evidences of their God. Obviously, man makes mistakes. This is what Christians say all the time. Man makes mistakes. Man are flawed. Man are sinners. You got to depend on God. Okay? Where are you at? I'm waiting for God to show up. I'm waiting for the evidence. And if God doesn't provide it, then I will remain an atheist. As simple as that.
Although I'm an atheist also, I have long been a Buddhist as well, and some Buddhists are atheists and some aren't, but
yep.
I've also always been amazed and amused by the arguments that Christians deploy against other religions like Buddhism. One of the things that they say about the Buddha, for instance, is, well, the Buddha didn't die and get resurrected the way that Jesus did.
Right.
It's like, well, where do you start with that kind of an argument? Well, okay, yeah, maybe
exactly.
He didn't.
Right.
Well,
so
what? Even if Jesus was resurrected, so what does that prove about anything?
That's a very good point. You're right. Even if. Same thing with when you have creationists trying to refute evolution. They think that if they can somehow destroy evolution and prove evolution false, by default, Christian theology is correct, and that we all must now become Christians. And that's not the way it works. All you probably have done, and I haven't heard them do it well, but if they can disprove evolution, that's all you've done. You haven't proven a God. And so, again, my position is, well, prove to me that there is a God. If you can't, which more than likely you can't, then I'll wait for God to do it. If God doesn't do it, then I'm going to die an atheist. And again, how can God send me to hell for being what he knew exactly what I'd be? Because he failed to provide me the sufficient evidences. And very good about the comparisons with religions. You're right. They pick and choose. So what? The Buddha did some things that were interesting, too. Christianity doesn't have that. So you're right. Using that argument, they should all be Buddhists because there are things that the Buddha did that Jesus didn't do.
Exactly.
And it works. And all religions have their own miracles and their own wonderful things about them and the magical stories and the fantastical stories. And we have to really think about that. And why don't we accept these beliefs? I think it's very important that we look at that and say, why don't we? And when you do that, people begin to realize, well, wait a minute, my story has some of these, or my beliefs have some of these same elements. So why do I accept this? And most people really just accept it because they were raised that way, not because they really put any deep philosophical thought into it. And me being raised here in Atlanta, Georgia, a former church member myself, I'm telling you, that is the truth. They just haven't really thought about it.
Reggie, we're going to have to stop there. I've been speaking with Reggie Finley. He's the producer of Infidel Guy Radio. You can catch him at infidelguy.com. And I really want to thank you for coming on again today. We always have a great time when you come on.
No problem. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.